This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the bat for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Thank you very much. Thank you and welcome to the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. It is the Ray Lucia program, along with Johnny Dean hanging in there. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Took a big swig of your diet, dude.
That was, you know, supposed to be a secret. We're not supposed to have... This is behind-the-scenes stuff that we're doing here. Well, I need the swig because, you know, you and I were out rehearsing yesterday for a couple hours. We were singing and playing and
doing all the stuff in the band. I was singing and you were playing. I'm trying to get John Dean to sing a little bit. He's got a great ear, and he's one of the best keyboardists I've ever played with in my life. You really are a good keyboardist.
Oh, thank you.
And I actually heard you last night.
You could actually hear what I was doing.
Most of the time I can't hear you.
I've been playing for 50... Well, since 1967, what is that? However many years it is. 52 years, so you learn a thing or two.
Yeah, well, you did a great job. It was really a lot of fun. We'll have to take the show on the road. See, you think we can get the band members to go city to city?
I would hope
so. And entertain our folks all around the country?
I would hope so. I was told we have a gig on the Tonight Show coming up sometime in the next 20 years. That's what they said. Come back in 20 years.
With Johnny Carson, I think.
That's right.
Welcome, folks. We've got a big agenda today. Lots of stuff in the news. Obviously, we're now beyond the 10-year anniversary of the stock market recovery.
The bull market. However, we should keep in mind that unless we hit a new high, and the last high was somewhere in...
Are you getting technical now?
Well, I am, to the point that if for some reason the market dropped and we, you know, from here and we didn't hit the next high, it would revert back to the previous high, which would mean that it never actually reached 10 years.
Exactly.
So I just thought I'd throw that out for technical reasons.
You would do that.
But we are over, it was over 10 years ago when everything looked rotten, didn't it?
It actually did. And as you know, I was alive and kicking back then and doing all my thing.
Yeah.
And it was kind of interesting because I recall we talked about some very smart people like Bill Gross and others who had forecasted that it was over. And a smart guy. He just retired, by the way, from Janus.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
So a smart guy, and the Dow's going to go to 5,000 or some crazy number. And we were critical of it then. We're critical of it now. But I did think that we would talk about a couple of things today, the bull market and being over, and the fact that if you had a 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds back then, what do you suppose your mix would be today if you have failed to rebalance?
Back when? In 2009?
Well, say at the bottom.
Yeah, okay, so 10 years ago. 60-40 then, goodness. And you never touched any of it?
Haven't touched it.
80-20, I don't know.
Not bad. 85-15.
Okay, well, that
so think about that,
reason.
Folks. Now, one would argue that you should rebalance, I don't know, quarterly, annually. I don't, and I'll have John Dean quiz me on that in a little bit. But I start today with something that I've talked about many times on this program before. It's the dividend aristocrats. Do you know what they are?
I know what dividends are. I know what aristocrats are, but I don't know that I've heard those things put together.
Do you know that the dividend aristocrats are king?
Well, so now I'm seeing aristocracy and king and all this stuff. No, I didn't know that.
All right, folks, sit back, relax. I'm going to tell you all about it right here on the Ray program.
We have to do this. Yeah. I forgot.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So the dividend aristocrats have been around for quite a long while. And in reality, if you go back in time, you can see many, many, many companies that are substantial companies. Many of them are Dow companies, not all certainly, but they are companies that have raised their dividends every year consecutively for at least, think about this, 25 years in a row.
Wait, they've raised the dividend every single year?
Every year for 25 consecutive years. So here, ProShares obviously created some of the ETFs that do them, the NOBL and some of the others. Nonetheless, they wrote about it, But I found this so fascinating because I've talked about it many, many times on the air. If all you wanted, and I don't suggest, by the way, that you take your entire equity portfolio and put it all into the dividend aristocrats, but I think it's a really nice core strategy. So here's what they had to say. There's 57 companies in the S&P 500 dividend aristocrats. 57 companies. Headliners like Coca-Cola, J&J, Sherwin-Williams, McDonald's. They've all raised their dividends every single year for the past 20 years. Some companies have raised their dividends for over 50 years. How do you like that?
They can't be raising them by much.
No, they didn't say they raised them by much.
But they were in positive territory. Understood.
Part of them want to stay in that elite group.
And it's probably a very good idea. It's very attractive.
And you remember last week you and I talked about that very subject, that if you left your companies alone for a 15-year period.
Your dividend-paying companies alone.
15 years from now, it's not likely that even in a market crash that those dividends would go away. Remember that conversation?
I do, and it was all actually kind of news to me that they would not. But you're right. It stands to reason that a company would not want to cut their dividend because that's like saying we're done, but don't look at us for the next 10 years.
So I thought I'd pick out a few of these companies that have raised their dividends for 56 consecutive years and give you how they've done in the last 10. How's that sound?
The actual companies?
The actual companies.
These are not recommendations buy.
No.
I always just thought I'd throw that in.
No, but
yeah,
go ahead. You could buy the ETF if you wanted to. It's all up to you. So the dividend aristocrats for the S&P 500. Now, there are many, and I'll get into those other ones in a second. 3M up 14.55% for 10 years. Coca-Cola up 10.07. Colgate-Palmolive 7.83%. Dover, 13.59%. They're the equipment company. Emerson Electric, 7.66. Genuine Parts, 12.05. J&J, that's Johnson & Johnson, 10.06. Procter & Gamble, 6.46. That was the laggard. Stanley Black & Decker, 15.11. Who would have thunk that?
They've done 15.11% over the last 10 years.
And who does Spam? Is that Hormel?
Hormel, yeah.
19.69. Spam selling pretty good.
Spam?
I grew up on it.
Spam?
Yeah. Hormel up 19.69% over the last 10 years. Now, if I was on the air with you 10 years ago, if we were sitting around talking about, hey, you know what, let's think of one stock that we'd really like to buy over the next 10 years. Would Spam come to your mind?
No. Awful.
Very interesting. So these particular companies, the S&P companies, are pretty resilient in up and down markets. So we went and looked, or at least ProShares did, looked at how resilient they were in Q4 of 2018. Just to give you an idea of downside capture.
These same companies?
The S&P companies, the whole 57 of them.
Yeah. All right.
So the S&P, as you recall, declined more than 13% in the three-month period from October 1, 2018 through December 31. The S&P 500 dividend aristocrats lost about 8.63%. Now, if you have followed many of my teachings, one very compelling one is this. The best way to win sometimes is to keep from losing or, in fact, lose less, right? Because if you lose 25%, you all know you got to have 33% just to get back to even. Well, if you only lost 8.63% when everybody else was going down 13, I guess you're feeling a little bit better. Not feeling great, but a little bit better. And it wasn't limited, this downside capture thing, wasn't limited to just the large cap stocks. It also applied to the dividend growth strategies in U.S. mid caps, measured by the S&P Mid Cap 400 Index, the S&P Mid Cap 400 Dividend Aristocrats, and the small cap stocks, comparing the Russell 2000 Index to the Russell 2000 Dividend Growth Index. So you can find dividend paying stocks in the small, medium, and large cap sector. if you looked at the October through December quarter in 2018, as I mentioned, the S&P 500 aristocrats -8.63 compared to -13.52. The S&P 400 dividend aristocrats, that's the mid-cap 400, -8.5 compared to -17.28. And the Russell 2000 dividend growth index, -7.98 compared to -20.20.
What does that tell us?
Best way to win in investing is to keep from losing or lose less. More on this topic when we come back.
Download the BizTalk Radio app, available in iOS, Android, and BlackBerry. BizTalk Radio.
See, one of the great market prognosticators of all time, the Rolling Stones, of course, figured this one out when they came up with this song.
Well, you figured it out, or we all did a long time ago. I mean, everything. When you think when you think about it, every single problem, 100% of the problems of humanity have been solved by what?
Patience.
Patience. The gradual rotation of the earth. That's it. And in investing, it's the same thing. Time.
I never
mitigates.
Thought about the gradual rotation of the earth part,
that makes sense. Isn't it true?
Absolutely.
I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
World War II was solved by that. You know, this. Go back. The plague was solved by that.
So we've been talking about aristocrats, the dividend aristocrats, and they really fall across both small cap, large cap, mid cap stocks, and they've been pretty effective over time.
Now, before the break, you were throwing out some numbers. You were saying, 20% versus this. I think you just need to explain. I was saying here during the break that maybe we need to explain what you were comparing here.
You know, that's why I have you here, John.
To remind you. that didn't sound good for me.
I'm kidding.
But no, explain what you were comparing here.
Okay,
because it's important stuff.
So what we're talking about now is a dividend-paying company, or companies, I should say, that have had a history of raising their dividends on an annualized basis for many, many years. And we were talking about 25 years in a row with the S&P 500 dividend aristocrats. And I was comparing what happened in the last quarter of last year to give you an example of downside capture. I'll get more into that in a second. But basically, when I said I'm comparing the dividend aristocrat index at -8.63% to the quarterly loss of the S&P 500, so that's the comparison.
Yeah, so what you've got is you've got the whole, for example, the entire S&P 500 versus this group, this core group of dividend, long-time dividend-paying stocks. And so you're saying let's compare the entire S&P 500.
500 stocks or so.
Whatever it is.
To the 57.
To the 57. And then you did that not just for the S&P.
But the 57 were the ones that actually raised their dividends every year for the last 25 years.
Right, which I think helped the S&P overall. You also did the same thing for Russell.
For the mid-cap index, the S&P mid-cap aristocrats, -8.5, versus the S&P 400 mid-cap index, -17.25.
So the dividend paying aristocrats, as you called them, in this index
in the mid cap
did
space.
Much better than the index overall.
Exactly. Lost less. And then in the small cap index, the dividend growth index for the Russell 2000 small caps, down about 8 compared to down about 20 for just the simple Russell 2000.
And this was just during the October to December, the final quarter of 2018.
Raja.
Okay, so that's it. The whole secret is to lose less.
So when we talk about evaluating stocks or funds or managers, one of the things that we've discussed on this program many times is the up capture ratio versus the down capture ratio. So what does that mean? Well, let's go back to the dividend aristocrats. The S&P 500 produces X. In an up market, the aristocrats actually captured almost 92% of that up market in the S&P.
So if the S&P were up
a dollar, they'd,
a dollar, they'd go up 92 cents.
Right. Yeah. Now, you have to also look at how much of the down capture that they acquire. So if, in fact, the S&P went down a dollar, then the aristocrats would only go down 75.46 cents. In other words, they capture 75% of the downside risk and capture 92 for of the upside reward.
Better to capture more of the upside and less of the downside.
Yeah, it's a great combo plate. In the S&P mid-cap, they capture, boy, this is impressive, 99.35% of the upside and 72.10% of the downside.
Okay, can you, a couple things. First of all, can you explain why? Is it because people have more faith in these constant dividend-paying companies?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why, but if you think about it logically, when the market is going down and you're a dividend-paying company and you take those dividends and reinvest, what are you doing?
You're dollar-cost averaging into that downward cycle.
So therefore, you're buying the shares more cheaply, and as the shares appreciate, obviously the fact that you bought more of them gives you that advantage.
If I buy more seeds in my garden, when it rains, I'm going to have more crops.
Man, I love your analogies.
I'm pretty good.
You are pretty good at the analogy department. I forget the one you pulled out of
my hat?
Yeah, your hat last week. It was quite good, but I can't remember what it was.
I'll go listen to the tapes and find out.
Sisyphus. No, that was my lawyer pulled that one out.
Sisyphian,
whatever, Sisyphus.
Yes.
The Russell 2000, you capture 85%. Yeah, 85% of the upside, but you only capture 50% of the downside. So if you do subscribe to the whole concept of the best way to win many times is to lose less, then clearly you want to have your aristocrats in your portfolio. But as I mentioned, I don't want my entire portfolio aristocrats. I want it as a core in my portfolio because you're eliminating a lot of the growth aspects in the small cap arena and the international and emerging markets. So you still need to have other diversified approaches. But having aristocrats as a core, boy, it makes a lot of sense.
You say as a core, you know, I get $1 million again. This is a lot of money, but just for easy math, $1 million in my, you know, equity portfolio.
So just stocks.
Just stocks, right. You're saying a core. What would a core be approximately?
Maybe 40%.
And I know everybody's situation is different. Yeah. It depends on how old they are and all that stuff. So maybe 40% and the rest diversified among small cap and all that other stuff. Sort of the standard asset allocation.
Sure, because remember, you've got other real estate that may or may not be part of an aristocrat portfolio, even though it's dividend paying. Many of the small cap growth companies, international markets, emerging markets. So you still want to build around it. And remember, these are not concentrated portfolios to a large extent, although one might argue that a 57 stock portfolio is somewhat concentrated compared to a 2000 stock portfolio if you bought indexes throughout.
Oh, sure.
But for me, and I've said this many times before, I'd love to have some of my allocation in a highly concentrated best picks, most conviction stock allocation.
Now, are we talking about somebody who's not yet retired and is still in the accumulation phase? Well, or are we talking about somebody who is retired, like you mentioned last week, which was an excellent discussion, by the way? I thought we really hit it out of the park. For somebody who's either going to let the dividend sit for 15 years because it's a rotten time to do it, or they're going to start taking them. I mean,
You're going to have to ask me that question on the other side of the bridge.
It's a loaded question. It was a lot to talk about.
So we'll do that when we come back. Stick around, folks. This is the one talk show you must tune into. The Ray Lucia Show, back with more info right after this.
being a business owner.
Send us your feedback by emailing info@biztalkradio.com, or you can send us comments via the BizTalk Radio app.
There. All right, we're getting it on right here on the Ray Lucia Show. I know you had some questions, Johnny, before the break. I can't remember.
You know what? I don't know if this is going to a discussion you want to go. My question was this, and you can leave it alone if you want.
No, I'll take any question. I don't care.
I had asked you during the last segment what you thought. You said 40%, give or take. Again, everybody's different.
Well, it was 40% allocated, aristocrats across the board. 50%, it wouldn't bother me if it was 50 or even 60.
Okay, this is for of dividend-paying, big dividend-paying stocks that have been paying them for years and years.
This is someone that's a ways away from retirement.
Okay, so that was the question was, this is somebody who's in the accumulation phase.
Yes.
Somebody that has time. You said about 40%. After retirement. My question was this, because after retirement, nobody's going to want to be 100% stock in their portfolio. You designed or talked about it last week where you parcel off a certain section. So maybe only 35% or 40%, something like that, is going to be in the equities at all of somebody's portfolio. You're going to have maybe some sort of annuities, some sort of real estate, and all this other stuff that you talked about. So now that I've only got 35% of my portfolio in equities at all, I'm wondering, my question was, do you still believe that of that remaining portion of equities, it should still be 40% of these dividend aristocrats once they retire? Or can we make it maybe greater than that?
Well, I think it should be, and I'll tell you why. First off, remember, when you're 10, 15 years away from retirement, that's when you want to start to pare back on your stock allocation. And one of the beefs that I have with target date funds is they keep paring back all the way through retirement, which makes zero sense in a lot of different ways that I don't want to get into, but I've gotten into before. So if you're paring back on the amount that you have in stock, the thing to do would be to pare back on the riskier stocks. And as we've just determined, riskier stocks are growthier stocks. They're more international, emerging market based. So yes, I would expect that if they've got a really good financial advisor, they should be walking them through this. Mm-hmm. And so between now, let's say you start preparing for your retirement, let's call it 10 years ahead of time. 15 might be a little too much. So you start preparing for retirement 10 years ahead of time. You begin to pare back on the amount of risky stocks you have, but you don't abandon the dividend paying ones because, as we just mentioned, they're a safer bunch. They lose less during market crashes by and large, and you're able to reinvest those dividends. Now, it's still not a huge problem because when you start retirement, you will have pared back enough of the stocks that you're going to have another 15 years before you even look at them, which gives your stock portfolio a 25-year head start. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we talked about it last week, and you said how much you did, ran the numbers.
So whatever stocks you have in your portfolio 10 years prior to retirement should have a 20-year, call it, run without having to get too crazy. So I don't get wiggy about it, John, because even if you entered retirement and your portfolio didn't have 50 or 60% dividend payers, you got another 10, 15 years to pare it to the point where that it does. So this is why it's so critically important that you have a relationship with a financial team that understands retirement planning.
It's vital, in my opinion. I'm glad you said 15 years. I'm about 10 years minimum from retirement, and I'm still 100% aggressive growth.
Okay, so let's just
in my 401k.
Let's just take you as an your 401k, but you may have other assets that aren't
so
aggressive.
I do.
You also have home equity. We've talked a little bit about this a week or two ago.
Yeah.
But let's just take you as an example.
Yeah.
If you're 10 years away from retirement, then you sit down with Chris and you say, you know what? We've been 100% aggressive in our equity portfolio. It's done us very, very well. It was a brilliant move. You were just a genius 10 years ago. You've made up for your past sins.
I was not
without
a
even
genius.
Going to confession. I'm impressed. I am really impressed.
So
you've done super, super well. So yeah. Now is the time where you start to say, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't be 100-0. Maybe we should be 90-10. And then maybe next year, maybe 85-15. And then as you scale it back to when you begin your retirement, the day you start,
yeah.
I would suggest no more than 40% in equities.
What am I moving the, I'm 90-10, let's say, next year. What is that 10 going to consist
well,
of?
Well, I've got to start filling gaps, John. So in your particular case, we've got a wide open arena here. So bonds, you know I don't like them. I don't believe bonds should be in a retirement portfolio, but certainly having some bullet contracts, CDs, bonds, fixed annuities, fixed indexed mm-hmm. annuities, we would go through the myriad of choices and allow you and Chris to make that decision which way you would like to go. It's not going to matter to me. If you said I want to buy laddered bonds over the next 10 years, and every year those bonds mature, I'll buy a new 10-year bond, that would work out fine. I don't think your yield would be as much as perhaps a fixed annuity might generate for you.
It wouldn't.
But maybe you do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It really comes down to comfort level, because in reality, the difference in return, maybe it's 1% one way or the other. I'm more concerned about on the day you retire, you have an ample amount of liquidity to draw from so that your equities still have another 10 to 15 years to grow. Why? Because there has not been, remember this is such a key statistic, since 1950, there's not been a 25-year period where stocks have done less than 7.94% compounded over that 25-year period. So 8%, that means you're going to double your money 9 years later. That's a pretty good deal.
Now, we're talking about the allocation of my 401k, my wife's 403b, right? This
yes.
is really what we're talking
uh-huh.
about. So let's say I pare it down, 90-10, 85-80, and I over the years. Is it important in your opinion, and it would be to me, that any new money going into that 401k be directed not toward that 10%, 15 fixed, whatever those are, but all the new money going in directed toward that 80% equity or whatever I have. You know what I mean?
Well, no, because I know exactly what you mean.
I would normally put it across the board, which is what I'm doing because I'm 100% equity, aggressive growth.
Yeah, I gotcha.
What's your recommendation?
Well, my recommendation on new money going in has pretty much always been that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck in equities, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're able to dollar average. So in that particular example, you don't mind the crash because you're going to be adding, not only will your dividends mm-hmm. be reinvested at the lower prices, but your new money
sure.
will be going in buying in the lower prices. So, yeah, I would begin to pare back, like I said, on the riskiest
right.
stock allocations, not the safer ones, and the safer ones are the dividend payers. So, yeah, I would definitely want to allocate the new money to equities.
So when you do this, when you change your equity allocation in your 401k especially, because this is most of the time where your new money is going in, when you change that, it's important to also change where your new money is going in. It's not just a matter of changing your asset allocation to where you make it a little bit safer, a little less volatile, let's just say. Pare back on the more volatile assets and add less volatile assets. But that new money going in is going to give you the most bang for your buck.
Yeah, I will say yes, contingent upon someone whipping out this calculator. Sorry, we're on radio, and I'm holding
the calculator
up to the
whipping
camera.
Whipping this thing out. It is a calculator.
It's a calculator.
Yes.
And doing some interesting mathematical exercises, because I've got a lot of thoughts on that topic.
Could you see any benefit to continuing to just, you know, put new money into 90% or 80% of my equities and another
sure.
20% in the safe?
I could see benefit in staying 100% invested in stocks. Remember, my risk tolerance is very, very high. But I would also have to make a commitment to use my equity, my home equity, to buy me time if, in fact, the market goes through some kind of a gyration in the first few years. That is a riskier proposition.
Yes.
I think using home equity is a good idea for many of us. And I think in your particular case, by the time you retire, your two kids should be married and you've got grandkids and everything's going to be rolling right along. And if the home equity gives you the ability to stay in the market longer, mm-hmm. my suspicion is, in particular if the market crashed, that the home equity, even though it's an expensive loan per se, it's expensive for the children, but in comparison to what your market returns will be subsequent to a crash, I don't think it's even close. So yes, I could make a case for you to stay more aggressive, but you and Chris, and I know Chris is really, really conservative and would fight me probably tooth and nail
on the home equity thing.
On the home equity thing.
I was just going to say there are people out there getting heart palpitations when you said that, because you're talking about borrowing money from your home to you know, pay your bills.
I'm talking about your kids borrowing money from their inheritance.
Well, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly
what it is. Okay, we'll take a break on that note. We killed a whole show on this one thing. Oh, my gosh.
Good stuff, man.
I love it. We'll be back.
Starting a business can be tough.
To the bullish market. Keep listening to Biz Talk Radio. Online at biztalkradio.com.
All right, welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show. That's me, the Ray Man, Money Man, as they say, along with Johnny Dean, who's got some emails in his hot little hand.
I do, and we had a question, too, from somebody. I won't do it this hour, but it has to do with this whole qualified charitable distribution thing that we talked about last week.
Oh, I had a wonderful conversation with a beautiful lady by the name of Carol. Oh, Carol, I am but a fool.
Oh, really?
Yeah, over the weekend, as a matter of fact.
You're working over the weekend.
Everybody's working for
the weekend, and you are working over the weekend. Well, next hour, I do want to talk a little bit more about this.
Okay, we can do
that. This is a strategy you just don't hear a lot.
We can do that, sure.
And anybody who's charitably inclined, whether you're giving it to, doesn't matter where the money goes, and you are at least age 70 and a half, you have a required minimum distribution, but you're over the actual age of 70 and a half, you got to do what we're going to do next hour.
Sure. Yeah, I had a great conversation. In fact, I just got an email from her on my cell phone.
Oh.
Thanking me for the time. She's a sweetheart. Really, really a sweet woman.
Oh, well, Carol, there you go. Happy to have you as a listener and or viewer. All right, so let's George here. My wife and I are retiring in 5 years. I'll be 62, and I expect to need about $10,000 a month.
Hmm.
Social Security should bring about $40,000, so I'll need an extra $80,000. So in other words, 120 minus 40, now he needs $80,000 a year. What are the best strategies to employ at this point? I don't know if we have enough information to answer, but we can try.
Well, we don't, because we don't know how much he's got saved and how it's invested and so forth. But let's think through this whole proposition. He needs $80,000 from his portfolio, evidently, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what did we just talk about? We talked about having a certain amount of liquidity available on the day that he retires. He's 5 years away from retirement?
5 years.
So if I need $80,000...
So he's 57 now, I guess.
So let me just plug into my little calculator here. $80,000 in payments for 10 years, call it at 3%. So he's going to need about $682,000... to take care of 10 years worth of $80,000 beginning 5 years from now, right? So 682, 5 years from now, present value. So probably about $600,000 I would park right now in a pretty safe place. So what does that do? That means the other monies that are invested, say, in stock, and I'm giving you the way, way oversimplified version of this. But the other monies that are parked in stock right now would have a 15-year waiting period before you touch them, right?
Yep.
So, in other words, you'd have 5 years to wait, 10 years worth of income. That's where the $600,000 comes in. And anything else that's left over has a 15-year horizon. So let's say the guy's got $1.2 million right now. So he would have $600,000 in safe money, $600,000 in equities. And the $600,000 in equities, if in fact he did this thing the way I would do it, has a 15-year run rate. Maybe he's lucky enough to get 8%. So he'll have $1.9 million in equities 15 years from now. If he only gets 7%, he'll have $1,650,000 15 years from now. So that's the way that I would structure it. So what's his name again?
That was George.
George, based on assuming you have $1,000,002, and I'm making that number up, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have any other income items, and I don't know if you would be game to take some money and invest in real estate or deferred life annuities or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But just playing the stocks, bond, cash game, I'd be about a 50-50 mix right now.
Yeah, it's doable. But again, George, email us back and give us more details, if you would.
You bet.
Ellen says, I hear you talk about real estate. This was a discussion from last week. This came in over the weekend. I hear you talking about real estate. How do I know which type of real estate to buy and how to buy it? This is a good question, and I think we did talk a little bit about things like you mentioned, single family homes, rental properties, and things like that. But it runs the gamut.
Well, it's very, very difficult, Susan. In fact, I'm going to head over to Las Vegas this coming weekend. Or is that Ellen?
Ellen, yes.
I'm trying to meet with a property manager over there. For many of the people that want to retire out of California, by the way, to a tax-free state. This SALT deduction thing is having an impact on Californians, New Yorkers, New Jerseyans, and so forth. And having a domicile, which means you live somewhere else more than 184 days or 2.5 days a year, means that you wouldn't be subject to the tax situation in that particular state. And, of course, as you know, California has a very high state income tax, as does New Jersey and Oregon and other mm-hmm. places. So more and more people are interested in moving out of places like California for that and many, many other reasons that I won't get into since I'm a Californian.
Well, you got to remember, too, and there are a lot of people that do that, but you got to think, when you leave a state that's got a high tax, you're going to go to another state that's going to make up its lack of, if they're a no tax state, they got to make up for it somehow.
Yeah, Nevada makes up for it in gambling debt.
Gambling, but it's not always. And it's an interesting thing that they have, because I've got a couple relatives that live over there, and they're telling me there are just some really sneaky ways. You don't think of it. Texas is another place that doesn't have a state income tax, but then again, you've got
property
taxes and things like that. So they're always going to make up for it in some fashion. You got to consider that before you move.
But having said that, there are a lot of different ways, Carol, that you can buy real estate. It doesn't have to be a single family home, although most people are more comfortable with owning the kick the brick real estate themselves than going into a fund of some sort or a REIT. And REITs are correlated very closely to the stock market. In many instances, in other words, if the market drops, your real estate's going to drop too. I would talk to a real estate professional. But remember the advice that I gave last week. If you're writing about our discussion, because we had a lengthy one on this, I always look at what happened to rents during the last couple of recessions, because in order to keep your tenant in the building, you may have to reduce rents. And if you're buying a piece of property where you have to reduce rents beyond what you can afford, then that's not a good idea for you. You need to have staying power. You need to have liquidity. But for the most part, I don't mind that as an investment for income in a portfolio in retirement. It's sort of like getting an annuity without having to go through an insurance company, but keep one thing in mind. Mm-hmm. An annuity comes with the big G word. And real estate comes with the P-I-A words. P-I-T-A.
Principal
interest. It starts with pain.
Oh, gotcha. All right. I was trying to think. Principal interest, taxes, annuities? No. All right. Oh, we're out of time. Doggone it.
All right. Email me. Go to raylucia.com, RayLucia.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. Now go out and make it a very, very wonderful day. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available to take your questions
online. This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home.